You should be proud of Mario, though.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is April 13th, 2015. On a bill that's set for a public hearing and possible work session, House Bill 3525 is not moving today. We've reposted that for next Monday. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2224.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2224 comes to you from Representative Coyle. The underlying bill creates an office of investigation in the Department of Justice to conduct investigations into elder abuse. However, we're here today for the purposes of the Dash 2 amendments, which deal with the duty to report elder abuse. Currently, public and private officials who have reasonable cause to believe that an elder is being abused must report that. Abuse includes financial exploitation, which is wrongfully taking the assets, funds, or property belonging to another. But wrongfully is not defined in this statute. So the proposed Dash 2 uses wrongfully as it's found in the administrative rules and inserts that into statute for the purposes of elder abuse reporting statutes.
Okay, thank you. Aaron Olson and Amber, please.
This 2224.
Yeah.
You go to any order, just remember to identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Amber Hollister. I'm the Oregon State Bar's Deputy General Counsel, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Oregon State Bar's Board of Governors. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2224 with the Dash 2 amendments. Over the past 4 months, I have been presenting CLE training, continuing legal education trainings to Oregon attorneys about their mandatory reporting obligations under the now amended elder abuse mandatory reporting laws. And as you might imagine, I received a number of questions. And so we're here today on behalf of the Board of Governors to request that the committee provide some additional clarity to specifically the term wrongful. And so the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2224 would add a definition of the term wrongfully to the statute. Under the revised law, a wrongful taking would be one carried out through deceit, trickery, subterfuge, coercion, harassment, duress, fraud, or undue influence. This language is based on already existing rules promulgated by the Adult Protective Services Division of DHS. And we believe this change will help clarify when conduct constitutes financial exploitation and therefore when a report needs to be made. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barker, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Olson. I am an attorney in private practice. I handle a lot of financial exploitation cases, and I represent victims of financial exploitation in criminal cases. I'm here to testify in opposition to this bill because I think it's not broad enough in terms of how it defines wrongfully or wrongful, and also because I think that the definition that this legislature puts into effect in any part of Chapter 124 is going to be applied to the rest of Chapter 124, including the statutory cause of action for civil abuse of a vulnerable person. In 2003, the Court of Appeals did define what wrongful means for purposes of financial abuse. They defined it very broadly, consistent with this body's creation of the vulnerable person statutes over the course of the last 20 years. I think that the definition that's proposed of wrongful for purposes of the mandatory reporting law would narrow this legislature's intent in terms of reducing the types of financial exploitation that would be reportable. For example, there is no part of the definition that's proposed does not include breach of a fiduciary duty, and that is perhaps one of the most serious and common types of financial exploitation that we see when it comes to the elderly and the vulnerable. This subject was before the work group on elder abuse, and it was before the financial exploitation subcommittee of that work group. There was no consensus as to how to define wrongful or to present it to the legislature. And until there is more of a discussion on it, I think that this body should await more meaningful input from practitioners, because regardless of what it says in terms of where this bill goes in Chapter 124, the trial courts are going to see that wrongful has been defined by the legislature, and they are going to apply it within Chapter 124 to the statutory civil cause of action as well. I don't disagree that we need a definition of wrongful to guide practitioners, but I think that that definition needs to be consistent across Chapter 124. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. I submitted written testimony, but it was late because this bill is still listed on the legislature's website as dealing with something that has nothing to do with this subject.
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for you, Amber. So Amber Hollister and Aaron Olson are two of the smartest lawyers I know. So when they come here in opposition, it's just trouble for us, because now we're going to have to sort this out. And just a question for you, because what Ms. Olson just said seems to make some sense, particularly, for example, involving fiduciary duty, et cetera. Can you tell us why, if at all, that we shouldn't be concerned about that, or why that your need for clarity and definition might trump that? Because she seems to be making some sense as a policy matter.
Chair Barker and Representative Barton, I'm happy to address your concerns. So as a starting matter, I will point out that the reporting obligation does have a separate set of definitions mm-hmm. from the financial elder abuse provisions that I believe, correct me if I get this wrong, ORS 124-100.
Yes.
So there are completely separate abuse definitions for each of those provisions. And so because they're separate, it seems to me that they could be separately and differently defined. So I'll start there. In terms of whether or not the scope of the definition of wrongfully is broad enough, this is a reporting statute. And so while I'm sure we could think of additional circumstances that might fall outside of that definition, I believe providing some clarity to mandatory reporters on what it is they need to report mm-hmm. is paramount. Because if people don't understand that they have a duty to report, they very well may not do so. And our interest is in ensuring that all mandatory reporters comply with the law.
All right, question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question of you, Ms. Olson. In terms of what Amber just said, again, this is, we're trying to sift through. She's also making some sense. Would it not be relatively easy for us to actually clarify in terms of provided the clarity with respect to mandatory reporting that Ms. Hollister is looking for without actually contaminating 124, which I don't think is anyone on this committee particularly wants to do. I doubt we're trying to narrow protections for vulnerable seniors or civil remedies or anything like that. But so again, she's making some sense in terms of clarity to make this mandatory reporting work.
Representative Barton, thank you. Let me give you a little bit deeper context. The discussion before the Financial Exploitation Subcommittee had to do with attorneys' liability for failing to make a mandatory report mm-hmm. and whether they could be found liable if they didn't. There was some concern over the definition of wrongful within that discussion. That's because the civil cause of action says that you commit financial abuse of a vulnerable person if you knowingly act or fail to act under circumstances in which a reasonable person should have known of the abuse. Mm-hmm. So if we're defining financial abuse for purposes of mandatory reporting law to mean something, then the statutory civil remedy may impose liability for failing to make a mandatory reporting a mandatory report when you're obligated to do so. So the definitions necessarily, I think, are related, and one is going to apply to the other, whether you specifically put it in that section or not.
I'm done, Mr. Chair. That didn't clarify it at all. I'm sorry.
Well, I would ask, is there still room to move to get the answer between the two of you? Can we get there without, I mean, I know we can't today, this second, but.
Chair Barker, I would like to see a definition of wrongful that applies to both sections. I don't think it's impossible. I just think it's a subject that hasn't had enough discussion among the various constituencies.
Ms. Grady, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Susan Gravy on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. And I do appreciate Erin coming forward and raising her concerns. A bit of background to help somewhat in an explanation of what we were trying to achieve is that this issue about the fact that there is not a definition of wrongful taking within the financial exploitation statute came up at the end of the year when the elder abuse work group that Representative Hoyle and Representative Gilliam are working on. They did not resolve it because they had other issues on their plate that they were working on. As a result, the mandatory reporting requirement went into effect in January. During the course of CLE presentations or continuing education presentations that our office has done and others have done, it came to our attention there really is no explanation of what you're required to report for elder abuse in terms of wrongful taking. What we tried to do is address just the mandatory reporting obligation and not the more controversial issue of the civil cause of action, which is it's a more narrow, depending on your view, I guess. Ms. Olson may have a different view. But our view is that the mandatory reporting obligation that all mandatory reporters have, whether you're a lawyer, a doctor, a police officer, you name it, many people have that obligation, so they need to have some understanding of what they have an obligation to report. And while it may not be perfect and it may not be all-inclusive, our thought was that coming up with a definition that at least addresses the reporting obligation made sense and leave the larger, more complicated discussion for later. And I went and addressed this with Representative Hoyle again after the Elder Abuse Task Force had submitted all their legislation, and she said, I agree, it's an issue. Or her staff said, it is an issue, we have a bill, feel free to move forward with it. That was our intent, to try and make it simple and straightforward and use the administrative rules that are already in place that people are using to assist with that definition. And that was our intent, to try and keep it narrow to only the mandatory reporting obligation, not to the civil cause of action, and let us deal with that at a later time.
Representative Barker, just one final comment. If this goes forward, notwithstanding the concerns that have been addressed by me, and I know that somebody else has submitted written testimony who just found out about the bill, that you at a minimum add breach of fiduciary duty to the mandatory reporting obligation, that being one of the most significant forms of elder abuse that I see.
Representative Krieger, did you have a...
It would seem you should be able to put right in the statute the wording, it is only to apply to this. Limit its application right in the law. Then they can't be using it over here. Judge, men in black robes, do not apply it over here.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, the language that we crafted addresses only that portion of the statute, the mandatory reporting portion of the statute. So by definition, it would only apply to the mandatory reporting obligation. I do think, though, the point Ms. Olson raised is very well taken, and we would not have a problem with a friendly amendment to include breach of fiduciary.
Okay. Anything further? Well, thank you for your testimony. I would hope we could get a quick amendment and fix the problems as you're seeing. Get it back here. So close the public hearing, House Bill 2224.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll post that for work session next Monday. Representative you and Representative Olson, do you have the time? No.
On that bill?
Yeah.
I'm happy to do so, Mr. Chair. It's a tricky one.
You're tricky. You'll fit right there. I thought you said we were not. They are here, still here. They
didn't run away. Okay. You want to stand at ease for a second?
Yeah, stand at ease for just a few minutes here. call the committee back to order and open a public hearing on House Bill 2354.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2354 deals with drones. In 2013, you may recall that we had House Bill 2710, which provided guidance and certain restrictions on the use of drones within the state of Oregon. This particular bill in 2710 and 2013 created a civil right of actions for individuals who did not want drones operated over their property. The operator must have flown the drone at an elevation of less than 400 feet over the person's property on at least one other occasion and had been notified by the property owner, landowner, or tenant not to do so. The successful plaintiff could recover treble damages and attorney fees. House Bill 2354, as amended, would remove the 400-foot restriction, thereby allowing an action to be commenced regardless of the height at which the drone is flown. In addition, the measure changes the term drone to unmanned aircraft systems throughout the statute to be consistent, and the difference between the dash 1 and dash 2, if you're looking at those, is that dash 2 puts the word drone back into the statute so that if folks are doing a Google search, it will hit on it. We are ready to move this bill today. There's no fiscal impact, no revenue impact.
Mitch from the Department of Aviation.
It took them down. They're identical with just a little additional language.
Please.
Good afternoon. I'm Mitch Swecker, the director of the Oregon Department of Aviation, and I'm here today to let you know that HB 2354, with its two amendments, is a result of collaboration between the drone slash UAS stakeholders that met recently with the help of Judicial Committee Counsel Channa Newell. And the department became involved with these stakeholders as a result of House Bill 2710 and the report that I provided to the legislature. So the bottom line is that there is agreement. I don't know of any objections from anybody, to my knowledge, that objects to this. And I've talked personally to the ACLU and to the Trial Lawyers Association, Art Towers, and the Criminal Defense Association. I believe Gail Myers is also in here. And the Dash 2 amendment is a result of some comments made by Gail Myers. And then I've also talked to AUVSI, which is the Association of Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, and they don't object to it. So there has been coordination amongst all stakeholders that have participated, and subject to any questions, that's my testimony.
Are there any questions? Representative Krieger.
Who's the landowner and who the drone belongs to?
Who the drone belongs to? Any particular one?
Yeah, one flies over, goes around your swimming pool, stops and watches you. You shoot it out of the air?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, probably not. That would be a federal offense. But there will be a if it's either public use or commercial use, they'll be required to have an identification number. And if you recall from the report that I wrote, my recommendation in the long run is that we register all of them for that very reason, though you can identify all of them, including the recreational ones.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Post.
I don't know if this is a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman. I've been struggling with this all day today, and I think I just heard Shanna say the original bill said we're changing the name from drone to unmanned aerial system. Then the dash one kept that, but the dash two chains it back to a drone. No. So did
Chair
I miss
Barker,
something? That's
Rep.
question
Let me
one.
Clarify this. The underlying bill we did is a placeholder. So we changed the word drone in the underlying statute to unmanned aerial system, which I thought was consistent with the term used in industry.
Okay.
After our work group met, we decided that the term unmanned aircraft system is consistent with the federal law.
Yes.
So that is what the change was made to. However, by changing that, we removed all references to the word drone, which meant that if somebody Googled drone statute Oregon, they may not find it. So the dash two added in lines 6 and 7, unmanned aircraft system means an unmanned flying machine, commonly known as a drone. So that's the only place it will occur in the statute.
Okay.
So it will be referenced as the unmanned aircraft system, which is what the federal regulations use. However, it will continue to have the one appearance of the word drone so that people can find it easily.
Okay, then a follow-up. This is one of those bills that, to me, was like, what is the problem we're trying to solve? This seems like the most colossal waste of time I've ever seen in my life. Sorry, no offense to whoever worked on it. But
oh, you're new here. I do that all the time.
I just took a 5-page bill, made it an 8-page amendment, and changing a name from one name to another. I'm just trying to understand what are we trying to solve here, and why is this important?
Chair Barker, Representative Post. The Dash One Amendment is the substance of the change. And what it does is it takes a state law that says you can't fly them any lower than 400 feet over private property and aligns it with a federal law which says you can't fly any higher than 500 feet. So what it does is it makes it, it takes the restriction away and makes you subject to privacy violation at any altitude, regardless, instead of 400 feet. So instead of at 405 feet, I'm protected. At any altitude that I violate somebody's privacy, I'm not protected. So it's the intent of the operator that's changed by making this by making this amendment, the Dash One Amendment, part of the law.
Well, I don't know that anybody will be able to answer my question. So I'm not mad.
As Representative Greenick said, you're new. This is the biggest waste of time you've seen so far.
Okay. This might be 1A.
Yeah.
Okay. So
okay.
I don't understand what we're solving here.
Thank you very much.
Kind of like the gun.
Just want to close the open the public or close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2354.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 23-2 amendments to House Bill 2354 into the bill.
Representative Williams moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2354. Is there any discussion?
I'm not opposed to this issue. I'm just opposed to this period. So I'm going to be a no for that reason alone. I'm just, it's a colossal waste of time.
Okay. Call the roll on the putting the amendment Dash 2 in, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Greenwick?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Post?
No.
Representative Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Williamson?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Dash 2 amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2354 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2354 as amended to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Question, did we move the Dash 1 and Dash 2 already?
No.
Or does
Dash 2.
Does Dash 2 include Dash 1 in it? And then, got it. Thank you.
The new saying, Mr. Chair, will be, I've been droned.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not with your shotgun. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Greenlit?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Post?
No.
Representative Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Williamson?
Aye.
Aye, motion carries. We won't make Representative Huffman.
It's happened before.
I'll have Representative Huffman carry that bill. And so I have to back up. I said earlier that we were not going to have a hearing on House Bill 3525, but it actually, what I was told and I misunderstood was we were not having the work session. So we will have a public hearing, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3525.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3525 deals with folks called notario publicos. And in some Latin American countries, these are the equivalent of bar-licensed attorneys. But here in Oregon, they are very frequently not attorneys, and they act as immigration consultants, sometimes getting folks into some serious trouble and sticky situations. We passed a bill in 2013 that would ensure that notarios are either notary publics or bar licensed attorneys. And if you're going to be an immigration consultant, you must be a bar licensed attorney. House Bill 3525 expands the crime of obstructing governmental or judicial administration to include actions that prevent a person from reporting another who is acting unlawfully as an immigration attorney. Consultant, excuse me.
Please, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, and Vice Chair Williamson, and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify before you. My name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I'm the state representative in House District 47 in East Portland. This bill, House Bill 3525, addresses the problem of dishonest immigration consultants, often known as notarios. The term notario público is problematic in that it creates a unique opportunity for deception. The literal translation of notario público is notary public. When a notary public in the United States is authorized to only witness the signatures of a form, a notary public in many Latin Americans and European countries refers to an individual who has received the equivalent of a law degree and who is authorized to represent people in front of the government. The problem arises in the United States when individuals obtain a notary public license and use that license to substantiate representations that they are notario público to the immigrant populations that ascribe a very different meaning to that term. Misrepresentations as to an individual's qualifications to offer legal advice can have severe consequences to immigrants. In many cases, the work performed by such individuals results in missed deadlines, the filing of incorrect or incomplete paperwork, or the filing of false claims with the government. The consequences of this has on the life of an immigrant are immense. They can lose opportunities to obtain legal residency, can be subject to both civil and criminal liability for filing of false claims, or can even face needless deportation. In addition, immigrants often spend hundreds, thousands, or even tens of thousands of dollars in payment for what they believe are the services of a licensed attorney. By promising too much and knowing too little, notarios often destroy the dreams of immigrants. They promise low-cost, quick results for everything from citizenship to green card renewal, but often do not even know immigration law. These notarios often take advantage of people from their own ethnic communities. Still, others take hard-earned money without ever intending to file documents or help in any way. Notarial fraud affects immigrant families and communities in my district, as well as throughout the state of Oregon. It's time to work towards a solution that will protect these vulnerable populations from dishonest and illegal activity. House Bill 3525 attempts to make this practice a crime of obstructing justice. While I realize the bill and the language that it has is in need of substantive improvements, my office is working extensively with the Department of Justice, as well as criminal defense attorneys, to arrive at a language we all can agree on. While we will likely not arrive at consensus before the bill deadline, I would appreciate this committee sending House Bill 3525 to rules for further work on this important issue. In closing, thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions, Representative? Thank you, Representative, for coming down and doing that. Is there anybody else here who wanted to testify on this bill? I think I ran everybody out. Okay, great. And I'm sorry about the mix-up earlier. I wasn't listening carefully, I think. You can go in any order. Just remember to identify yourself for the record.
Thanks. My name is Judy Parker. I'm an attorney here in Oregon. I'm also licensed in Washington, and I'm a member of the Oregon Commission on Hispanic Affairs. Thank you for the opportunity, Chair and committee members, for us to be able to at least talk to you about some of the work we've been doing on the bill and why it's so important. My commission was approached by the then Secretary of State, Kate Brown, about a year and a half ago to work more closely on strengthening penalties against notary publics that engage in fraud throughout the state and really put these folks, their clients, for lack of a better word, in these positions. So I just wanted to tell you guys about some of the steps we've been working on. We've been working on this particular bill, not necessarily the specific language that you see, with the Department of Justice, members of the Criminal Defense Bar, various advocacy commissions, district attorneys, and the State Bar, to try to craft something that is a very common sense approach to strengthen some of these laws. And unfortunately, the gentleman who stepped out, District Attorney John Haroldson from Benton County, would have had some great anecdotes for you about some of the personal struggles he sees and his inability to prosecute some things that he has in there. ORS Chapter 9 has some penalties for violating the unlawful practice of law, including this specific area, but it doesn't really go far enough. So some of the detectives and district attorneys have really urged this passage. Again, we'd really like to be able to work with the other stakeholders and get a bill that everybody thinks is good. Thank you.
Thank you.
OK,
Good afternoon. My name is Shapan Sinlapasai Okamura, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Commission on Asian and Pacific Islander Affairs. But I also am wearing my hat as a DOJ Immigrant Crime Victims' Rights Subcommittee Chairperson and the President of Immigrant Refugee Community Organization, which brings in refugees for the last 37 years from all over the world because of fear of being hurt, harmed, persecuted, and they're placed throughout Oregon. This story and the stuff that we're testifying to is too common, and it doesn't just impact the Latino population. I want to share with you the story of Adan, which means monk. And I think stories sometimes paint the best picture. He was brought into the United States by a temple in the state of Oregon to help develop the multiple temples throughout Oregon, Washington, California, and Idaho. He was here, and after 2 years, the temple realized that because of his expertise and his relationship in building the community, they wanted to keep him here permanently. One of the board members for the temple met an immigration consultant. He promised that he would do everything right to help Adan receive his green card and then a pathway to citizenship so that he can improve the temples inside the United States. However, we quickly realized that Adan and the temple were duped, and after they hired a proper attorney to help them with the litigation, they realized it was a little too late, and when they approached the family and the friends who found this connection, they were approached with threats, harms, and these are very serious, too common consequences in our community, not just the Asian Pacific Islander, but our African Somalis, our Muslims, and as we diversify in the state of Oregon, I strongly recommend that we look at giving teeth to our laws. Our Oregon State notarial regulations is not strong enough. Giving someone $500 and a possible 6-month jail time when you've actually deported someone who has helped to change the face of our nation is too devastating. And I strongly and unwaveringly support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and committee members, my name is Alberto Moreno, and I have the pleasure of serving as a chair for the Commission on Hispanic Affairs. And in that capacity, we represent the needs of over 500,000 Latinos across the state of Oregon. I'm here before you today to ask for your help with this growing problem in our communities. Notary publics, not all of them, but some of them, disproportionately target our communities, misrepresenting themselves as attorneys or providing legal counsel in naturalization processes and proceedings. Unfortunately, as you've heard today, they are not qualified to represent our communities, and many of our community members are defrauded of thousands upon thousands of dollars from their hard-earned checks. Additionally, it places in jeopardy their eventual qualifying for some of that adjustment of status, which I think is just as significant as the thousands of dollars that they are defrauded of. Additionally, these unscrupulous notary publics are also often used intimidation, as you've heard today, and the threat of use of force. The other tactic that they engage in is if a community member is unhappy with their representation, they will threaten to call immigration. They will threaten to get some type of action against the applicant. House Bill 3525 begins to address this problem by providing that using intimidation or fear to prevent a person from reporting violations of ORS 9.280 is a Class A misdemeanor. House Bill 3525 is a measured response to the all-too-common practice of using fear and intimidation. We ask and urge your support of this bill. We know that it requires additional work. We want to work, as you've heard, with our partners to make it the right bill. But this is a growing problem, and we really look to your support and your assistance to ensure that all of our communities are protected and preserved in this great state of Oregon. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much, panel. Is there anybody else who wants to testify on this bill? Okay, thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3525. And jump back up and open a public hearing on House Bill 2960.
Can I ask, if this opens again, will it be for the purpose of moving it to rules?
If it's not ready, yes.
But I mean, that's where.
We have it scheduled for a work session next Monday, and it's not ready to move it. That's my intention. We open a public hearing on House Bill 2964.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, House Bill 2964 comes to you from Representative Barton. The underlying bill asks the Law Commission to submit a report on protected persons subject to guardianship and conservatorship, but we're looking at the proposed Dash 1 amendments today. It replaces the measure and includes a conservator of the estate of a child as an additional party who may maintain a cause of action for recovery of damages. There is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. This is ready to move should you choose to do so.
Okay. Janet Conley, please.
Thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Shannon Conley. I'm an attorney with the law offices of Nain Friedenberg in Portland. Our firm deals with minors and incapacitated individuals who will be receiving proceeds from a wrongful death or personal injury lawsuit. I'd like to start with a couple definitions for my testimony. A conservator is a court-appointed fiduciary that manages the income and assets of a minor or incapacitated individual. A guardian ad litem is a court-appointed fiduciary that represents the best interests of a minor or incapacitated individual just for the duration of a claim. In Oregon, a conservator and guardian ad litem are permitted to appear as a party on behalf of a minor claimant. In some situations, you would want both a guardian ad litem and conservator to be appointed, but often it is just preferable to have the conservator to keep cost and delay down. The reason the conservatorship is preferable is that not only can it provide the majority of the duties provided by a guardian ad litem, but it can also manage the money from the proceeds after the claim has been resolved. The wording in Oregon Revised Statute 31.700 currently only permits a guardian ad litem to bring a request for injury-related medical expenses on behalf of a minor claimant. This creates an unfortunate situation where there may only need to be a conservatorship, but if there are going to be injury-related medicals included in the damages, you're going to have to appoint a guardian ad litem as well. And as mentioned previously, this does cause additional expense and potential delay for the minor claimant. So I think it's great that we're adding the conservator to this statute if it does pass. And thank you for hearing my testimony. If you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Great thank testimony. You.
Thank you. Close the public hearing. Open work session. House Bill 2964.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2964.
Representative Williams moves the Dash 1 amendments in House Bill 2964. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2964 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2964 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. First. Thank you. Open a work session on House Bill 2329.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2329, you heard on March 26th. This is the increase of money to the legal aid account by $3.1 million. It does have a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
So we're ready now? All right. Mr. Chair, oh, you got to open a
work session. No, we are. Right? We're in work session. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2329 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2329 to the floor with the due pass, subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Representative Krieger.
Just have a question. There's no increase in the fees, so you're changing the distribution. I don't remember testimony as saying if there's $3.5 million going to be taken, where's it being taken from? Who's not going to benefit from that three and a half because this is going to another source? Do we ever hear anything on that?
That will be the discussion in Ways and
Ways
Means.
Ways and Means.
How does a legal aid increase fit into our Ways and Means conversation? Okay. Stay tuned.
Yeah. Any further discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Further business today?
Thank you, committee. We are adjourned. Thank you, committee. We are adjourned.